just, I don't know that I was feeling a lot of anything, you know, like I think I was predominantly just crazy, like, and I think that was a coping. That was a total coping skill. I mean, part of it was I was trying to save my brother, and I felt the urgency of it. Like, I was terrified he was going to die. You know, like, this wasn't like a, well, if, you know, if we don't get him help, he might die one day. I was like, my reaction was as if my brother was going to die in 10 minutes. Like, it was very intense.
Guys, so once again, it's just Dr. Lisa and I in this episode. And today we revisit her story. We did it back in episode 101 and gets into more detail than this one does. But we thought it would be kind of pertinent to go back and talk about some of her experiences, as you know, Ashley Stossom has focused on the family members right from inception. And we got back to kind of some of that. And we focused more on some of the ways she felt throughout all of this as well, rather than just kind of tell the nitty-gritties of the detail of her story, being the loved one of somebody who suffers an addiction, of course, with her brother. So check it out, guys. I love these episodes, and she's such a great co-host. And keeping on that theme, the title sponsor for today is Far Canada. Now, Far Canada is a they're a nonprofit, they're a volunteer-run charity, and their focus, it's families for addiction recovery. Their focus is in all the families of people who suffer an addiction, which of course is right down my laneway. So I'm really happy to have them on as a sponsor, guys. There's all sorts of resources there. They do need volunteers for their peer-to-peer support thing that they've got going on there. Check it out. It might be a good fit for you. Or if, of course, if you need those resources as well, get back and check them out, guys. Anyway, guys, I hope you enjoyed the show, and thank you very much for all of your support. Hello, everybody, watchers, listeners, supporters, all kinds. Welcome to another episode of the Ashes to Awesome podcast. I'm your host, Chuck LaFlange, in Krabi, Thailand, halfway around the world in virtual studio. My beautiful co-host, Dr. Lisa. How are you doing today, Lisa?
I'm good. How are
I'm
you?
good. I'm great. I'm really happy to see that you are wearing the You Are Loved hoodie. Really happy
Right?
to see that. Yes,
I
yes.
know.
That's the first white, second white one I've seen with the
Yeah.
black on it like that. So yeah, right.
Yeah,
So
no, I love it.
yeah, it's
So
pretty
we got a
cool, eh?
few of
It's
them,
pretty
right?
cool.
'Cause mom and dad ordered them, so
Okay.
we'll get a group shot and post it so
Yeah.
you can have a look.
Can't wait to
They're
see it.
nice and
Can't wait to
it's like
post it.
nice and light. Especially like spring, right? So having something
Yeah.
that's not super heavy,
Yes,
but
absolutely.
it's very
And
nice. I like it.
so many of our followers, supporters, whatever you want to call them, are in the US, you know, further south. Things get a little warmer. They don't never have need for a thick hoodie, as it were,
Yeah,
right? So
exactly.
or bunny hug, as they're called in Saskatchewan. So
That's right. I forgot about that. I
Oh
learned that on this
yeah. Yes, you did. Yeah, when we had Todd
podcast.
on, right? We'll have to get Todd back on one of these days, actually.
Yeah.
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 You know, as we're just before we're recording, we're talking about future guests. Zane, we got to get Zane back on. Not Zane. Yeah.
Zam. Zam.
Zan.
Yeah.
We got to get him on with you and I, actually. Yeah, we really do. So, yeah.
I'm
As
trying
you
to
know, I've been
think. When
thinking about
Zam
doing
was
a
on, was
recovery
I
coach.
on? Or was
No,
it
you
just you and
weren't.
him?
It was
Oh,
just him and
okay.
I. And it was a long
Yeah.
time ago. It was
Yeah.
single digits. It wasn't
And I
single digits.
noticed too, he's
No,
been
double
doing
digits,
some,
but just, yeah.
he's been doing some different stuff, you know, because he does his like, I don't want to, I'll get this wrong, but it's like coaching, and I think
He's a
it's
recovery coach.
right, more for men, I think. I'm not saying he doesn't take women, but I think more for men. But anyway, he's been doing some stuff too, so it would be interesting to have him back on. And I haven't seen
Absolutely.
Zan in so long, it would be great.
I actually, as I've been like looking at getting accredited as a recovery coach, I came across, I don't remember which company it was, and I'm not going to plug them now anyway, but there was Zan as one of the
Oh.
graduates, right? Just
Oh,
randomly.
really?
So
Oh,
yeah.
wow.
Gonna have to get him back on one of these days. So Zan, if you're listening,
Yeah.
get in touch with me. ADHD says that I probably won't remember to get in touch with you until one day when I'm in a pinch and you'll feel like I'm, you know, using you as backup or something. So right? It's usually how this goes, right? So and I know he does tend to listen or watch the Weekend Ramble. So exciting news this past week. Of course, well, she's already title sponsored one episode, or they have Far Canada, Families for Addiction Recovery. And they are the title sponsor of this episode as well. Back to, not back to, but continuing on with the underlying theme on this show. And of course, we are an addictions podcast. However, I think what separates us from many platforms is that we put so much focus onto families, right? And I'll explain why that is. It's something I've explained in many messages, and I don't know that I've ever actually said it on the podcast. Where that comes from, where for me, where the need for that comes from is that, you know, and I've said before on the show, 10% of the resources go to people to, you know, how do I say that? 90% of the people affected by addiction aren't the people who actually suffer an addiction. It's their loved ones. And they get maybe 10% of the resources. So that's not that I think we should have less resources going to people who suffer an addiction. I think there should be more going to the families. Yeah. So that's a qualifier I have to throw in there. But I also don't believe that most people in active addiction, and you can't say all, but I think it's safe to generalize in this case, aren't tuning into a podcast. And though the recovery stories are very important to be told, I think they give hope and support mainly for people that have already found recovery, more so than the people who are in active addiction. But the families of those people, all the loved ones, not just the families, the friends, everybody else are desperately searching for resources all the time. As you know, because of course you are the loved one of somebody who has suffered an addiction, right?
Mm-hmm.
And well, that's how we became, you know, mm-hmm. friends and now co-hosts on the show. So,
yeah.
So I guess, can you do the Reader's Digest version of, you know, because not everybody knows your story, right? Like I tell little bits and pieces of it quite often, but yeah.
Right. Yeah. I know. We haven't, it's funny. I haven't told this story in so long. Because I think the last time I probably told it was with you a year ago.
Episode 101. Yeah, right.
Yeah. Well, that's right, actually. Yeah, like I talk a lot, so I'm going to try to make this Reader's Digest. But but so I grew up in a little town. My parents have been together since they were 13, and they're like two teenagers still. But like a good home, good community. You know, when we were little kids, we had a lot of extended family in the same town as us, and kind of like your typical, you know, Brady Bunch sort of childhood, right? We had supportive parents. We financially were, you know, comfortable. Our parents had us in activities. They were present. And neither of my parents abused substances ever. My mom did grow up with alcoholism in her family. But for her, the result of that was to sort of swing the other way where, you know, I've said it before on the show, but at her and my dad's wedding, she drank apple juice in her wine glass because she was like in her late 20s before she would even drink wine. I think she had just grown up, you know, as a childhood of alcoholism and had so many bad experiences that she wanted nothing to do with it. So we didn't grow up seeing people, you know, using, there was wine around like, you know, for special meals or something, but minimal for sure. But again, respecting now that we do have like a pretty significant family history of addiction, just not in our own parents, not in our immediate family. And so I have a brother who's 4 years younger than me. He was a really, really, really good hockey player. And when he was a teenager, you know, him and his hockey team would go to parties. And I think that's where he first got introduced to drugs. So, you know, with a bunch of really good kids who were, you know, good students, great athletes. And I've heard stories from friends of his, you know, only hindsight kind of deal, but about how, you know, they would do drugs at parties and they would do drugs, but they'd do them and eventually they'd just fall asleep, pass out, whatever, you know, because they'd be at a friend's house kind of thing. And then they would, one of his friends told me, he said, like, we would all pass out. And he said, but I remember times I would kind of wake up at some weird hour of the early morning. And he said, like, if there were drugs there, your brother was the guy who was still up doing them. And everybody else was asleep. And I think there were many years where he, I think, was abusing them. There was definitely signs that he was, you know, his use was concerning, that he would go on to develop severe addiction. And then I think what ended up happening is he had actually gone to a dealer looking for cocaine. And the dealer said, well, I'm out at the moment, but I've got crack. And he'd never done it before. So now you've got somebody who I think at that point had some level of addiction, and he's standing in front of a dealer expecting to get something and getting told, well, all I've got is this stuff. And he has said to me that from that first moment, like, it was a changed game.
As you know, I can relate to that myself.
Yeah.
My whole life turned the moment that I, in my case, switched back to crack. So I did it for a while, quit for almost 20 years, but the moment I,
you know, and if you look
up,
at, oof, yeah. Right. And if you look, you know, cause they, people who do research, which is not me, but researchers look at, you know, levels of dopamine in your brain with various things, right? Whether it's a hug from your kid, whether it's a glass of wine, whether it's sex, whether it's drugs.
Good
and if
food,
you look
exercise,
at the,
all the things, right?
Yeah. All of it, right? And if you look at crack compared to cocaine, because like even in the hospital, like I'll have patients when I do a drug screen who'll be like, oh yeah, I use cocaine. And I will say to them, like you snort cocaine up your nose or you're smoking crack? And they'll be like, oh, I smoke crack. And it's like, okay, not the same thing. And I don't know if they know that and they're minimizing it, because I think there is more stigma, right? Like I've been told that cocaine users will still belittle crack, you know, people addicted to crack.
Of course they do, yeah.
Right? And so, but if you look at the there's a significantly huge difference in the amount of dopamine influx you get in your brain when you use crack cocaine, right? Yeah. And so, you know, this was like this evolution over a number of years, and it kind of culminated to a point where I was in grad school. So I had moved out and done an undergrad. And then when I was in grad school, I had moved home, and he was attending college. And so after us having not lived together for a number of years, we were both living together, and we knew something was wrong. And now in hindsight, I guess that's one of the things that stands out, is for families that don't live in this world, it really can happen right under your nose and you don't know.
Of course.
You know, yeah. When I look back, when we finally learned what was going on, my 6-foot-tall brother weighed 120 something pounds.
Yeah. It's happening in front of you. So it's that gradual.
You don't,
just like you don't
see
notice
it.
Your kids grow so fast. It's, you know, it's the same idea. You're not going to notice somebody close to you shrinking.
Yeah. Which I feel like people who haven't experienced it, cause I think I would have been like, oh, come on, give me a break. But no, like you really don't see it. And I think there was just a lot of ignorance there. And for people out there who get to live in that ignorant bubble, like, go you. Because, you know, the reality of this is so dark and terrible that, you know, count your blessings if you have never had to and never need to know about this stuff. But so we kind of started to know something was wrong. Like, it was things like with sleep pattern, for example, you know, because he was in college and he had gone from being quite motivated, and we would, you know, he would be up, and he was a morning person by nature. So he would be up, he'd be ready to go. He, you know, he'd be doing homework in the evenings, and that all started to sort of change. And so I remember this one night, and again, it's like you're talking 20 something years ago, but I remember this one night very clearly, where he was home and he was upset, and we were kind of like, there's something going on, like, what's going on, and trying to have conversations with him. And he admitted something was going on, but had a very hard time telling us what it was. And I think there was just a lot of shame. And when he did finally tell us, at that point, he had actually done a bunch of research. Like, he had looked for programs and, like, you know, what he needed to do. And when he did tell us, he said, like, that he had debated just leaving and going to these places and, like, leaving us a note, you know, because he didn't want to tell us what was happening. But having said that, also, more ignorance is that this place that he had in mind was not, you didn't go there for free. you know? And you needed to detox before you could show up at their door. Like, they wouldn't take you until you had proof that you had detoxed. And there was all these steps, right? And that's one of the problems too, is that people don't know the steps. Sometimes people don't have time for the steps. And I do feel to this day, like, a lot of those steps are barriers. because they, we eventually, and I'm kind of going ahead and back and ahead and back, but he did eventually go to the program, the one he had found. And we ended up finding out later that the government had this thing where they would fund it through provincial health, but there was all these criteria. So to have it funded, you know, the person needed to be seen and assessed by a psychiatrist, okay? I can tell you that to be seen and assessed by a psychiatrist today in Alberta, you're looking at like a 3 to 6 month wait. So you're going like, if somebody is in that position and has this moment of clarity where they realize they need help, you want them to go to the family doctor, get a referral to see a psychiatrist, wait up to 6 months. And I'm guessing, because this was in Nova Scotia, I'm guessing Nova Scotia is even longer. I could be wrong, but I would guess it's longer. But so wait 3 to 6 months to be seen by a psychiatrist in order for you to then go to this program and get financial support.
Crazy. And of course, what? How long ago was this now? Just for some perspective.
This was in about 2003, I think.
Okay, so times have changed since then. These are no longer quite the, I mean, there's other barriers, but I mean, you don't have to be seen by a psychiatrist to get referred into treatment now. That I'm pretty,
true. Yeah. I think, again, I don't do a lot of outpatient work, but yeah, I mean,
well, I know you don't in Alberta, but I would assume across the country it would be that way. Right. So,
but I don't know. There was a lot of reasons behind it. Like, part of the reason for him to go to this particular program is that it was a young adolescent centered program. And at the time, Nova Scotia had one adolescent young adult program. And here's another little fun tidbit. At the time, their program for teenagers and young adults closed down at Christmas, Easter, summer holiday, like what? Like, it literally shut down during holidays.
Well, we're in different times.
I mean, again, hopefully there's nothing like that anymore, but there was a lot of reasons why that program made a lot of sense. And we did end up, you know, squeaky wheel gets the grease. We did end up getting the money back from the government, but it was a huge fight. Like, I still have this binder, and I had literally made a list of every treatment program in Nova Scotia. I had called every one of them and recorded conversations with the staff. And in most cases, staff were saying, like, I would not send my child here. But documented these conversations, the names, reasons why, again, some of them, they were like, you know, we're also a 3 month wait to get in. Or, you know, we don't take people that do the drugs that your brother's using, or we don't take people your brother's age. There's all these various reasons. And so we did end up getting a meeting with the health minister in Nova Scotia. And in the end, we did get the money back. But it was like a lot of hours of like collecting data, you know, and for us, obviously, it was nice to get the money back. Like, these programs are not cheap. But there's a lot of people out there who couldn't afford to front the money and then hope to get it back later.
Money,
you know?
Aside, everything you just said, right? So, like, 6 month wait, 3 month wait, you're at 9 months, you know?
Yeah.
So if somebody's 18 years old, right? Like, 9 months is.
Yeah. Well, he came when we met with the health minister. He came with us and he said, you know, he said, if we had done what you're saying we needed to do, I'm telling you right now, I would be dead.
Well, yeah, right? Like, there's so many things that are wrong with that. But
yeah,
we are in a different time now. I don't know that the wait lists are that much. I mean, back then it was 9 months of this. Now I think it's probably 6 months of that. But, you know, like, to get it, maybe 3 months of that. But even that's way too long. Way
And it's
too
like there's
long.
still a lot, you know, like most of the time when I see this stuff now, it's with patients in the hospital, and we have like a team of people who assist them. But it's like there are so many programs, and while that's great, it can be really overwhelming for somebody suffering an addiction to figure out where do I go? Like step one, you know, I'm not going to apply to 20 places because just completing a single application for somebody in that mental state is really challenging. So I think that the process is can be quite overwhelming. You know, because we have like in the hospital, we have people who will come and sit with a patient, get their history, talk about, you know, their values, what's important to them, and then they will help them and say, you know, we think these particular programs are a good fit for you. Some of it's demographics too, like how old you are. Some of it has to do with what substances you're using. Some of it has to do with physical location of the programs. But we have a group of
Culture, all of
people,
it, right? Yeah, there'd be,
you know, who will come and help you decide, help you with applications. But if you've got someone who's living on the streets,
To put this in perspective,
speak
to
of
put it in
barrier, right?
perspective, if you remember, you and I, let's go back 6 months, 7, 8 months, maybe, when I was like desperately searching for some ADHD medication, and and I had to see somebody and get my healthcare number. Everything you just described is so many more times more stressful. And look at, like, for me, I couldn't, at the time, navigating that process was just like too much for me, right? So, and that's me sober, wanting to get my shit together, have supports, all the things. Can you imagine somebody trying to navigate the system that's just like very early in recovery without a ton of support? So, like, I've got some intrinsic resources too that maybe not everybody has. Like, there's so many, like, and that was almost impossible for me. Well, I never did get it sorted out, did I? Right? Like, I never did. So, I mean, I'm just thinking, like, everything you just said, there's an actual physical response in me right now, going, how in the fuck is somebody supposed to handle that? Right? And thank God he had you guys as family, but how many people don't have that? People in their corner, like trying to help them navigate all this stuff when you're just trying to survive, right? Because that's the
Oh,
reality of it. But
absolutely.
so I don't mean to cut you off, but so where, oh, so he gets into treatment and
Yeah,
then,
so he went to detox, actually. He went to detox, and again, ignorance. There was so much, like, I was so naive, right? But he went into detox, and I remember going home that night and being like, oh, okay. Like, you know, he's a detox, like we're good, you know, and
Oh,
we knew that
little
the
did you
plan was to
know.
pick him up from detox and go to treatment. But I think it was the first or second night that he was at detox that my dad called and just said, hey, just wanted to check in how he's doing. And they were like, oh, he checked himself out. And so he had used the phone, like the unit phone, called the dealer. The dealer picked him up at detox with a crack pipe ready to go and apparently told him that, you know, he's like, oh man, don't go in there. Like, you know, they'll make you crazy in there. And we ended up tracking him down. He showed up at a friend's house. And so we tracked him down later that same day and with friends and us, like, all convinced him to go back. And then I've told you this, but at the time, I was dating this guy, and so we sat in the parking lot for 5 days. Yeah, that was interesting. And it was also for me like so eye-opening because so he was, it was like a 2 or 3 floor building, and he was on the top floor. That's just where the detox was. And I remember sometimes he'd come to the window, and so like he could see me, I could see him, but he would call me. And like the roller coaster that we would go on in like a 10-minute phone call was wild. Like this was like my first exposure to the fact that your brain is not okay. Like he'd call me and yell at me and scream at me and call me names and tell me that I was ruining his life and all this kind of stuff. And then it's like he would break and he would be emotional and apologetic and like it was just wild, like the ups and downs. And I think it was just, you know, seeing him go through those cravings and seeing that like internal war in his brain. And I'm sure that I saw the tip of a massive iceberg to what he was actually experiencing. But so he ended up staying the 5 days because he felt like he couldn't leave because we were in the parking lot. And we picked him up, and I remember, like, we wouldn't stop anywhere. Like I don't even think we were willing to stop at Tim Hortons. It's like, we're not slowing the car down. If we slow the car down, this fear that, like, he'd jump out and run.
I want to suck you in there, Lisa. I've heard the story a bunch of times. I've heard it more than once anyway. And me being somebody, in his shoes, right? I can, like, oh yeah, totally see it. But as I'm sitting here listening to you this time, and of course the focus being on the family, I'm like, what about you? Like, how, like, awful or how terrifying or how, like, what's that experience like for you as his big sister, right? Sitting through that. And you've told us this story, but you've told it about what he's going through. What were you going through at the time? Right?
I think at the time I was like in survival mode myself. Like, there was adrenaline filled, fueled motivation. I was in the midst of grad school. I stopped going. Like, I did finish, but I went in to see my prof at the time and said, like, this is what's going on. I don't know when I'll be back. I think I was off for maybe a month or something. Wasn't a long time, but like, I was so hyper focused, it was like, and some of that's my personality. Like, I think everybody will handle that differently based on their personality, but I very much was motivated to fix. I was going to fix this. I was going to save him. I was very sad. Like, I remember, like I said, I was dating a guy at the time who was lovely, like probably one of the nicest guys I've ever dated in my life. And I just didn't give a shit. Like, I didn't care if he fell off the planet. I was so hyper-focused, like nothing else mattered to me. I remember being fully prepared to be out of school as long as necessary, to use whatever student loan money was needed. Like, I was in grad school. I wasn't earning, I think I was making like 20 grand a year, but I was like, I will pull student loans. Like, there was no stop for me to what I would do, and so just, I don't know that I was feeling a lot of anything, I think I was predominantly just crazy, and I think that was a coping. That was a total coping skill. I mean, part of it was I was trying to save my brother, and I felt the urgency of it. Like, I was terrified he was going to die. This wasn't like, if we don't get him help, he might die one day. I was like, my reaction was as if my brother was going to die in 10 minutes. Like, it was very intense.
And we joke about you being the muggles of the muggles, but in a circumstance like this, again, for me, like, it's like, okay, well, get our shit together. Like, I would be so much more calm about that because, okay, well, it's crack, it's bad, but it's not fentanyl. So, a very, very different thing for me because I have this lived experience as somebody who's been there. For somebody like yourself, what have you had? You've had just say no, shoved down your throat. You've had, all the things, same things that I have growing up, right? Like, because we're essentially the same age, certainly the same generation. And so you've got all these worst case scenarios floating around in your head, your younger brother, you don't know anything about that lifestyle.
Yeah.
I can only imagine. Right?
That's the thing is I think that there is a lot of, there's more fear, like similar to you today, because of the work I do, when I see a patient and I see families reacting the way I reacted. And of course, now I sit there and I have to try to balance validating them, being compassionate with them, and also thinking to myself, your kid's snorting cocaine. It's not good, but I don't think he's not going to die in the next 10 minutes. Opiate's another story, obviously, but with, like, for me, I literally, like, I've never smoked a joint. And I was always.
A lot of unknown there. My gosh, that's a lot of unknown, right?
So naive, right?
So much so that I just said, oh my gosh, for the first time in my adult life.
That's so much. The thing too is, like, as a kid, I don't remember how or why, but I was kind of fascinated by my mom's story, you know, like, because my mom was born in Montreal. And then when she was, I think, about 12 or 13 years old, she moved to Labrador, where I was born. And then she was raised for the rest of her childhood by her aunt. And I knew that. And I think, you know, I was never told the extent of things, but from a young age, I was aware of that and that that's not typical. And I would ask questions. And so I do think, like, in a very age appropriate fashion, like, I was told the stories, and it's because I would ask, like, I wanted to know. And so I knew from a relatively young age that my grandparents had struggled with alcoholism and the extent of destruction that it had caused in the family. And I think that that from a young age made me terrified of substances. You know, like I was a teenager who would go to parties all the time, and I would do one of two things. I would lie and tell people I was allergic to alcohol, or I would tell people I was intoxicated when I hadn't touched anything, because I was just like, I had heard these stories, and that combined with my personality, I was like, I'm not going there. But yeah, so I was like, I would say that in that time, like, I was very stressed out, you know, like, I'm sure if you had measured my cortisol level, it was through the roof. I was terrified, like, terrified that my brother was going to die. And probably more terrified than sad. Like, I feel like between the motivation and the drive and the focus to fix him and the complete terror that I felt, I don't know that there was a lot of space to feel anything else.
Fight, you know? There's no room for sad in there. No. Right, like that. That's those are.
No.
That's trauma response, right? 100%.
Yeah.
That's trauma response, right? If you had Mike here, he'd be all over this right now.
I know, I know, right? Yeah, I know. I'm thinking about all the parts of me, you know, all the parts of me. There was different parts of me at play there. That's for sure. And other parts, there was no space. There was no space for other parts in those moments.
No.
But you know, and I remember feeling a lot of relief when he got to treatment. The treatment center he went to was, I think, maybe 4 or 5 hours from where we lived. And it was also probably, it was a long, long way from a town. Like, it was in the middle of nowhere, like on a beautiful lake out in the country, which is perfect in my mind. But I was, again, also at that point, I was aware of the fact that his mind could change any moment. Like, I had watched it sitting in the parking lot of the detox center. Yeah. And so I was becoming less naive. I was still very afraid, but yeah, I don't know that I ever really let myself feel a lot of the sadness, you know? Mm-hmm. I think for me to sit and feel sad is like very vulnerable. And that's not a place I like to be in. Which, again, Mike would have a heyday, Ryan would have a heyday. But, you know, like, I don't know if it's being an older kid, like, I'm the oldest child. Some of it is just, you know, my dad is kind of that way. And I think, be it through modeling or genetics, like, that's just kind of the way I am. It's like, I like to fix stuff. And so, you know, I very much stayed for a very long time in a place of wanting to, like, I was just going to fix it. And there was no limit for me. Like I said, at the time, like, I probably would have bankrupted myself and sold everything I owned to, if I had had to try to get him help. And then I think I kind of switched at some point from being completely terrified to wanting to understand it. Like, again, then it, you know, and a lot of this is probably all my defenses, right? Because there's a defense known as intellectualization. And that was, you know, this desire to understand the science of it. Well, it's clearly benefited me. Like, it's how I ended up going to med school. But a lot of it was probably defenses. And again, we all have defenses. We all use defenses. And some defenses are healthy, some are not. And, you know, in terms of the way I went about it, like, do I think it was terrible? No. But I can kind of appreciate that some of it was probably about avoiding being sad. Or just feeling the sadness. And I think for me too, it's like, to sit and feel sad is not going to help anything.
No.
And that's not going to help my brother. if I sit here and cry, like, and I did cry. So I felt it. Like, it's not like I didn't show emotion. Like, I definitely had moments. Like, I remember this one night in my laying in my bed when he was in detox and just crying. So I remember my boyfriend being there and I just like, and he couldn't comfort me. Like, I was just like, I wanted nothing. I was just like, go away. Like, you don't get it. Just leave me alone. So I felt the feelings. But for me, predominantly, it was just a thing of sitting here and feeling sad is not going to help my brother. And helping my brother trumped feeling my feelings above everything. Like, because I was just like, I can feel my feelings later. Like, my brother's going to die. And so, like, screw my feelings kind of thing. But, you know, I probably didn't spend a lot of time. And I would say, like, over the 20 whatever years it's been now, it's been over 20 years. And there's been good times and bad times and periods of wellness and many relapses and all of that. And, you know, I've definitely been sad, you know? And the thing for me is, like, the sadness, it's for him. You know, I have moments where I feel sad that, like, you know, I might live a part of my life without my little brother in the world, you know, when I've thought, like, he could die, you know? And so that's sad. But the greater sadness for me is sad for him. Like, sad that he carries this burden in life, you know, because I look at it and go, I kind of feel like I am the lucky one genetically, you know, I think that we both come from the same gene pool. And there's no doubt for me that a huge component of what has resulted in my brother being, you know, living the life he's lived is genetically driven, you know, with the family history that we have, there's definitely a genetic piece to it. And I kind of feel like I got lucky. And I think sometimes I feel guilty for that. But for me, it's just like, I see the suffering. Like, I've seen it. I've seen it many times. The shame, like, it's just a burden. Like, it's almost like, to me, there's this big black monster that likes to hang on my brother's shoulders and tries to pull him and break him. And I feel like even when he's well, I think it's a fight. You know, it's not like I can see him when he's well and we'll go out and we'll have laughs and it's great. But I'm not naive anymore to believe that there's still not this big monster just waiting to try to destroy him. You know, and so, yeah, I feel like more sad that he has had to and continues to, like, carry this burden in his life. I've said to him before, like, I don't know that I would have the strength to do what he's done for the past 20 something years, where for the most part he has tried to fight this. Like, I don't know if I could have done it. I don't, you know, it may have broken me more than it's broken him, but legitimately, if I could take that from him, even for a time, I would do it in a heartbeat, you know? It's just sad, like, for anybody to sort of have to, you know, for, like, life is just hard enough as it is. Like, life is, you know, life is just hard with the day-to-day stuff. But to live a life where just breathing is challenging, just being able to get out of bed is challenging, you know, looking in the mirror where, you know, you look in the mirror and you know, if looking at yourself in the mirror is hard to do, like, it's just sad. Like, that's the sadness I feel. Oh. And, you know, because we've talked before about how, like, you've said that you like the idea of, like, turn your stories into thank yous, you know, which I love. But for me, I often think about that for families is, like, what if families said to their loved one, like, I'm really sorry that you're suffering. You know, I'm really sorry that your days are so hard. Like, I'm sorry that you may have all these terrible feelings that you don't know what to do with. Like, what if families did more of that? You know, like, how would that change things?
I wonder. I do wonder, right?
Yeah.
Instead of what is the default, anger.
Yeah.
Fear. All sorts of different resentments in there, mm-hmm. of course, right? Which are earned, and I don't mean to take that away from the loved ones, right? Like, it's like,
yeah,
it's a hard life, right? It's a hard life loving somebody who's suffering an addiction, right? There's so much going on there. There's so much going on. So how do you turn that into empathizing with somebody that you love, right? And I mean, I'm sure that if you love somebody, you're going to empathize with them on some level, right? But how do you go from being angry to saying, I'm sorry that it's like that for you, right? You got violent, you stole from the home, you ruined fucking Christmas, whatever. How do you go from that to, I'm sorry it's like this for you? Which is so understandable when, and I try to understand, I get quite upset with people sometimes, but, you know, tough love and freeze them out and wait for them to hit rock bottom. And you know how I feel about all those things. I've been quite verbal about that on the platform over these past months. But
I think part of what's hard too, like, well, so much, there's so many hard things. Prefacing it like that is not really helpful, but there's no answer, right? Doctors don't have answers. People with lived experience don't have answers. Family members who've been through it and their family member has died don't have answers. Family members who've been through it and their loved one has, you know, found sobriety and maintained sobriety, they don't have answers. Like, no one has the answers. That's what's hard is, you know, and as a family member, like, we've heard it all. Like, we've heard, cut them off. Don't answer the phone call. Don't, you know, don't help them. Don't feed them. Don't do any of those things. To, you know, everything on the other end of the spectrum, which is, you know, housing first models. And it's like, you know, house him and feed him and, you know, like the broad width of recommendations that you get, it's like,
it's crazy.
And like, as a family, you know, one minute you're going, okay, well, this guy seems to know what he's talking about, so I'm going to listen to him and we'll follow that advice. And then, like, you know, a week later you read a book by somebody who's also really reputable and you're like, oh, okay, like, he's saying do something else. And so it's like, it makes you dizzy because you're like, we don't know what to do. And
well,
I
can't imagine, I guess, but I couldn't have imagined before starting this podcast, but now I got a better idea.
Even in the hospital, like, I have these conversations with families every week, and I don't tell patients and patients' families that I've been in their shoes. Yeah. I don't always. There are times when I do, but, you know, I don't always. But I do sometimes sit there and in my head, I'm thinking, like, I know what you are going through and I still don't have an answer for you.
Right.
Like, I don't have an answer. And which in some ways, as I say it out loud, it's like, well, that sounds really hopeless. Hopeless and depressing.
I think, like, so much of this, like so much of the suffering, so much of the answer is, it's all on a spectrum, right? And it's also unique to each person. And we've said this a thousand times too, but there is no, like you said, there is no easy answer. And every soul is unique and every family is unique and every case of this disease is unique. And then you throw all that in together and you're coming up with a big slice of unique pie. And it's going to be different for you than it is going to be for somebody else in your family to deal with. Never mind another family. Never mind, right? Like, there's just so much going on there. And I'll take a minute here to talk about FAR, actually. Mm-hmm. FAR Canada. I chased, and peek behind the curtain. I've chased FAR, Angie, the executive director there, for the better part of a year now. and there's other organizations I could have approached, but mainly because their values align so strongly, right? And one of those things is that peer support system that they have going on there, which I think you can definitely relate to being an awesome thing. Not that you had the opportunity to use it, but it's for loved ones, and I think specifically parents, and we're going to get more into this as this relationship with FAR grows, but they match up peers. So if it's a mother to a mother, or their children have done, I hate saying children when we're talking about adults, but their adult children, they try and make sure that they're kind of using the same group of drugs, whether it's stimulants or opiates or whatever, you know, alcohol, whatever. Culturally, somebody's Indigenous or Caucasian, you know what I mean? Like try and, so they try and match up peers to peers to try and kind of negate as much of that individual uniqueness as they can and kind of bring people closer together. They need volunteers. So anybody that's listening and on, you know, north side of the 49th there in Canada, I mean, consider it. Consider it. There's it's a 25-hour training program. And if you need the system as well, give them a shout. There's a bit of a waiting list for the peer-to-peer, but they also have a line that you can call and get some support in the meantime as well. That's a kind of open during, you know, business hours-ish or whatever. When you and I first met, you had talked about, and I'm not trying to toot my own horn, about the need for a podcast that kind of address these things. So far, it's like, you guys are doing exactly the thing. And that's why I have chased them for a year and why I'm so proud of the partnership now, right? It's just, fucking bang on, right?
It's just meant to be. Right?
Yeah.
Match made in heaven.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. I will say like that was definitely something I think that we felt was like, we didn't really know where to go. You know, like we had a really lovely family doctor, who was sort of happy to support, but outside of, you know, going to him for support and then knowing that we could go to Al-Anon meetings, we knew of nothing, like nothing. We had no awareness of places to go and connect with other families, you know, and through even through all the time, like he spent probably a total of about maybe a year, because he went back a few times, but at this treatment center. And I mean, even there, like we ended up building quite good relationships with some of the staff at the program he was at. But I mean, even they, like they weren't like, oh, you know, we think you guys would also benefit from some support. And here there's these programs and, you know, nothing like that. And they did some family stuff. But again, it was family stuff centered around supporting him. You know, like I remember a meeting where we sat together as a family with the case manager and kind of talked about things, and everybody had a chance to kind of speak and share, you know, what the experience had been like for us. And but even through that, like you would think a program, and again, maybe it, I don't even know, when did FAR start? Do you know when FAR was founded?
I'm not sure. No,
we should check it. But you know, like, I feel like programs should be saying, like, you should reach out to an organization like FAR, and, you know, it'll help with education and support for you as a family member. And because just like we talk about, you know, AA isn't for everybody suffering an addiction. And I think Al-Anon is not going to be for every family member. Yes. And I don't think that the only support available to families being Al-Anon is I don't even like the word sufficient, because it's so not sufficient that like we need a word that's on a whole other level. But like we were never told about any kind of resources outside of residential treatment programs that said, oh, you know, we do some family work or we involve the family. But it's like, that's great. And I think that they should do that. But it's like, yeah, but you're involving the family in order to help the client, not to help the family per se.
Yeah.
You know, so there needs to be. And that's why I think like a podcast like this, because while we're saying that there is no clear cut answer and that that's really difficult, because when a family member comes, whether they come to me as a sibling of someone who suffered, whether they come to me as a psychiatrist, whether they go to you as someone with lived experience, as someone who has suffered an addiction, we don't have the answers for them. Like we really don't. But I think just being able to go somewhere, like listen to the podcast or connect with FAR Canada, to be able to talk to people who can relate, who can normalize things, who can validate the struggle and the challenges, like that's incredible.
Bang.
So it's...
Let's touch on that for a second.
Yeah.
All this energy goes into the person suffering, and it needs to. I don't ever mean to take away from that. I'll probably continue qualifying statements like this forever, but...
Yeah.
By saying that. But whoever validates that, right? When a mother says, my son is, right? People are like, oh, that sucks. You know, him, right? Yeah. But whoever says like, wow, that's hard on you, right? You know, like they'll help that person like blame, quite often. Yeah. That's, you know, but
and to be honest,
says,
I think,
you know,
I think even to get the reaction of, oh, that sucks, doesn't always happen. I think sometimes instead, depending on who you're speaking to, if you're speaking to someone completely naive with no experience whatsoever, I think that you also run the risk of not even getting the validation of that sucks, but instead you run up against stigma. Like, oh, well, what did you do as a parent? You know, what kind of mistakes did you make? Wow, like, you know, that
even
would never happen to my kid. Like,
even, oh, and you know, I've dealt with that one as of late. Even the fear of saying to people for fear of judgment, right? To your best friend, or to, like, how many people live these lives and nobody at work knows because they don't want to admit? Because what if they're gonna, like, people are gonna think this is my fault? Is it my fault? Right? Like, they're questioning themselves, and then they've got a fear of being questioned by other people or looked at by other people. And, like, that sucks, right?
Yeah.
The whole thing sucks. So I think that's something like a peer-to-peer is hugely important. And it's a network that needs to grow. I know there's similar programs in the United States as well. And you know, we'll get to those in another episode. But fuck. For every person that suffers, there's 10 that are attached to that person that are suffering right alongside and need that validation and need that help. And fuck, we'll get Mike on talking about the trauma too, right?
Yeah.
Like, everything you've just said to me, now that, you know, I've got this kind of Mike world around me now, right? With the whole trauma thing, it's the whole trauma thing. It makes it sound pretty fucking whatever. But like, I just, everything you're saying, I'm like, oh my God. How'd you deal with that? Like, have you dealt with that, Dr. Lisa? Like, does somebody, do you come to Thailand for a stay at the Yatra, right?
I would love to go to Yatra.
No kidding, right? Eh? No kidding.
The ice baths scare me a little bit. But outside
the ice
of that.
Baths aren't like, there's, when I was there, I think I was the only person who did them with any sort
of
regularity.
Really? No, but if I went, I would have to do them.
Of course you would. Of course you would.
Like,
I haven't done one since I left. It's been months now.
Oh.
Yeah.
I'd like to go for a cruise out there just to get in the ice bath.
Yeah. There's a time in there, and he's got more patience there now than he has before since he got out here. So it's a little tougher. But
yeah. No, I mean, it is. Like, it's, you know, it's that whole thing of, like, you know, trauma is not only having a gun put to your head and thinking someone's going to pull the trigger, you know, like, trauma, there's little T's, big T's, whatever you want to call them. But
complex, all the things, right? Wondering if your brother's going to die, rationally
and
or irrationally.
I used to have nightmares. I would have
and
nightmares
your parents,
where,
you know, like, the things they've gone through, you know.
Yeah.
Okay. Of course, I've had what is the honor and privilege of sitting with you and your family for a couple meals now, and there's some strength there that is awe, to say the least. Right. When we sit and talk so frankly about some of these things, but like, I look at your dad and think, how much shit did he suppress to get through that? Right. And
then
your mom as well. And like, wow.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And then, you know, your brother's got a wife and kids too. And like, so many people are affected by this.
So
right?
many. And that's
and
without even
worse,
trying to think of it, you know?
What's worse is we sit here and we point fingers and we blame and we stigmatize not just the person that's in it, but the people around them, but I'm trying to think how to verbalize this. Nobody gets a chance to fucking deal with it.
Yeah.
Right. And then
that's
when
true.
It's all said and done, it's never said and done. And this is something I spoke to in a blog post a long time ago about my mother. And this is a universal across the board. When I'm sober, it doesn't stop. For me, it stops. Right. Like, I get to be sober and I get to live this. Everybody's so fucking proud of me. And I started this podcast and yada, yada, yada. My mom, on some level, is going to stress for the rest of her fucking life.
Yep.
Right?
She will.
If I don't answer the phone for a couple of days, my mama is going to wonder somewhere. That's going to, over time, that's going to, but somewhere that's always going to be there. That's that goes for you. That goes for your parents. That goes for his wife. Ultimately, for his kids.
To be honest, right? Like, I've almost found that, like, during periods of his wellness, sometimes they've been some of the most stressful for me.
Oh, fuck yeah. Right.
You know, which is kind of messed up, because it's like, any amount of wellness for any amount of time is a good thing.
Damn
But it's
straight.
like when somebody is unwell, there's at least this, like, you get to a point of accepting that they're not well. When they get well, as messed up as it is, you almost become more anxious about when and will it crash again.
Yeah.
You know,
which
and
is earned.
So,
which, and my mom said to me, I'll tell you, the first time I relapsed after mom came and picked me up, when I came back, she said to me, I expect this.
Yeah,
and it was
you
like,
telling me that.
Fuck. It was one of the hardest things I've ever heard. And at the time, it hurt. It hurt. It cut deep. Right?
Yeah.
I get it. Now more so than ever, because we're all sitting around waiting for a fucking win here. Still, yeah. It seems. Right? And don't get me wrong. There's been some great long-term wins around me, and I think that's just about focus. But I get wrapped up in that, and that's not my kid. This is somebody else's kid that's been on the show, or this is a friend that I used to use with, or this isn't my kid.
Yeah.
Right? So, like, yeah, I get it now. I get it now more than ever, right? But at the time, it sucked to hear that, right? Fuck, it hurt. You know? But and so now she has to, not only does nobody get to validate her shit, but she has to fucking worry about what she says to me, because it might hurt my feelings.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, in an instance like that. Like, what the fuck? Right? There's so much
going on.
Well,
I remember when I couldn't get a hold of you that time.
Right?
Like,
right?
Right? Yeah. Like, it was interesting, because I would say, next to David, it's the only time I've ever had that kind of a reaction towards somebody that I was worried was using or relapsing or overdosing or whatever. And it was, like, the exact same feelings.
Yeah.
You know, like, again, part of my defense system, like, I literally was like, do I have to drive to Saskatchewan now? Like, is that what I'm doing? Like, do I need to go hunt his ass down? You know, but yeah, like, you do, you're always, and I remember having that internal dialogue where I was like, you know, he's doing well, like, he's, you know, you've been sober for a while, like, you're motivated in your sobriety, but the reality is that I also know that doesn't matter. Like, that can be gone in an instant. Like, you can have one instant, right? And also, I think, because I knew you were getting ready to go to Thailand. And I'm also very aware that there's that whole thing that people with addiction will do, where it's like, well, you know, I'm going to Thailand, so I'll just do one last little hurrah, you know?
One last hurrah. So, a lot of people have died in last hurrahs, right? So and you know that as well as anybody does. So I can only imagine. Right. And
you know,
I've said this before and I'll say it again. To me, and the more I think about that over these last months, like that instance there, it's like, fuck yeah, thank you. Right. I will never take that for granted again. Right.
Yeah.
I went years, literally years, where nobody checked up on me. Right?
Yeah.
And then so to go from that to you and mom freaking out, I actually, you know what? My ride back to Moose Jaw from Regina, where I was at the time, I screenshotted a text from my mom and sent it to her and said, could you get your fucking ass here, please? This is what my mom is doing right now. Could you get over here, right? Like, because you said you would be here fucking 6 hours ago. My mom is losing her mind.
Yeah.
Right? Like, could you just get over here and make this happen? What I ended up having to do is I spent the last of my money, every last dollar, on an Uber to go to her house, bang on the door and say, take me fucking home. You said you would.
Yeah.
Let's go. Right. Because I already paid her for the ride too. Right. So,
yeah. So
I'll
guess,
never take it for granted again.
That's the thing, is that I think more than anything is to acknowledge, like, the roller coaster of emotions that I think family members go through. Right.
Mm-hmm.
You feel sadness, you feel anger, you feel hope, you feel hopeless, you feel afraid, you feel anxious, like, and you know, varying degrees of all of those, I think, come and go. And I mean, it's exhausting. Like, it's exhausting to go through, you know, all of that. And I think that that's the reality for family members, is that they go through that a lot. More than I would say, like, if you try to think of other circumstances outside of addiction, what is another example where a family member would go through that varying degree of emotions over the duration of time that this goes on? Because as you said, even when you get sober,
there's nothing. There's nothing.
They still spend years like worrying about, you know, will it come back? Will you relapse? You know, whatever, yeah. You know, and I mean, I think sure.
I've said this before too, Lisa, but I'm going to jump on that real quick. For the person using, we get the, right? We get the break. We get to go get high. We just go do the thing that helps us not feel the things that we don't want to feel while our loved ones are sitting there feeling it, right? It's a shit deal. It's a shit deal.
Yeah.
Right. So,
and you know, I never, like, my brother was never a poor me kind of guy. Like, he's never blamed us. He's never acted like a victim. I feel like sometimes like he should act like more of a victim than he does. Cause I think that, you know, there's a lot of things in his story that have contributed to where he's at. And I think he's allowed to own that some of that stuff that he's lived through has not been fair to him. And he doesn't, he prefers to be like, you know, this is my choices, and he kind of owns it. So he's never been like, you know,
stigma doing that to him too, though. That's what that is.
Totally. Totally.
Right.
So he's, you know, I've never had him ever say, oh, you don't know what it's like, you know, like you have no idea, you know, poor me kind of attitude. But I have said to patients, you know, particularly if I have patients who are kind of playing that victim card, because that's not beneficial. It's not helpful to you to sit there and feel like you're a victim. The reality is, this is your reality. And now what are we going to do about it to move ahead? But I have said to patients who I feel like are kind of in a bit of that victim headspace that, you know, you're right. Like your mom has no idea what this is like for you. And you know what? You have no idea what it's like to be your mom.
No, right.
Like that goes both ways.
Yeah, I'm sure.
You know? And you were the first one that kind of like added that cherry on top of, and the person active in addiction does have the option, if they're using, to escape all of that for a time, and family members don't.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Right. And the victim thing, and I made a post about this a long time ago. Maybe it's time to repost about it, but if you get cancer, cerebral palsy, I don't care. Right.
Mm-hmm.
It's not.
Yeah.
Right. It's just not. But you have to do something about it now. Right. So you can sit around and you can be the victim. And I've had those moments. I've had lots of those moments. I still have those moments. Mm-hmm. Right. But this is the thing about it. And I think people twist this when I say it sometimes, is, you know, it takes away from it being a disease, because you don't choose to have addiction. You do have to choose the cure.
Yeah.
You do. And it's, you have to choose to do something about it, because nobody can do it for you. Right. Nobody can force you into chemo either. Nobody can force you to fucking get a kidney transplant. Nobody can, you know, force you into a liver. Nobody can, you know, nobody can force metformin on you if you got diabetes or you're in. Somebody's got to do something about it, and it's got to be you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just a reality.
And again, so, I do think that, you know, we talked about this last week, and I can't remember the context, but around how people react to validation versus when external people minimize, right? So if you're sitting there with somebody who's suffering an addiction and you're minimizing what it's like, or then the likelihood is what they're going to do is they're going to focus more on making you realize how shit this is. And that's not productive. So I feel like what, as a family member, we can do is not feed that, not sort of do things that get people stuck in this state of needing to prove to you how bad it is for them. But instead, if you validate, and this is true outside of addiction, it's true, I said it last week, I do this with my six-year-old. If you validate, like if you sit there and you say to someone in addiction, I can't imagine how hard your life is. I can't imagine the degree of suffering that you're feeling every single minute of the day. They don't have to prove it to you anymore.
Yeah.
And then instead, the conversation shifts to, now what do we do?
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. But if people sit there and blame and shame and minimize and invalidate, all they're going to do is focus on proving to you how bad it is.
Yeah.
And you're not going to get anywhere.
That's interesting. And there's a relationship with somebody in my family who, it's just like, if you could just validate that shit for a sec, because now you've got me thinking about that. And it's like, I'm very fortunate Most of my family is like, but you know, that there's a couple family relationships. It's like, if you could just validate what, like, could you please, please, right? And I've never thought about it before. But then I sit here and it's like the conversation stops because, like, you don't get it. You refuse to get it. You refuse to acknowledge it. Mm-hmm. And now I don't want to talk anymore about it, right? Like, I don't, you know.
Yeah. I feel like you either don't want to talk or you want to prove to her.
Yes. Yes.
Right? Prove to them. They, them.
Yes. Yes.
But, you know, it becomes about proving it to the person. Or as you said, which I didn't think about, but yeah, or you just decide, you know what, they don't get it. So that relationship's cut. And then how do you help support somebody and motivate them and be available to them if they have a moment of insight where they decide they want to get help if there's no relationship, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, validating somebody's suffering doesn't mean you're saying what they're doing is okay.
No, no.
You know, no. Like, you don't sit there and say, yeah, good for you for smoking a crack pipe. Good for you for putting a needle in your arm. That's not it. It's just to say to them, I can't imagine how hard your days must be. I can't imagine how hard it must be to live like this. You know, I can't imagine how, all the feelings you must feel. And the defenses come down. And then you can actually have, hopefully, a more constructive conversation. Yeah. Right?
And if you can't, fine. The odds of that happening, though, are so much better. Right? Yeah. That constructive conversation. Right? They drastically improve once you validate. And I think it's interesting. I'm going to have to really mull that one over because it's not something we've talked about specific to this scenario before, but I think that's a huge piece of helpful advice to somebody, right? That's got a loved one.
And, you know, again, I think it's also to be explicit. Like, it's okay as a family member that you're not always in that headspace. You know, it's okay that you have moments where you're angry. Like, you're just pissed off that this is the stuff.
You've earned it. Right?
Yeah.
You've earned it.
Right? But I think, you know, if you're able to get to a place of being mindful of when you are in that anger state versus when you're not, and to recognize that, like, speaking to a loved one in addiction when you're angry is probably not going to be helpful to you or them. And so feel your anger, be angry, but maybe that's a time when you speak to somebody that you're connected to through FAR Canada, or maybe it's a time when you listen to one of these podcasts, or, you know, do other things in those moments.
Yes.
Yes. You know, it's not always, you know, even it, and it doesn't matter how long you've been in it. It doesn't matter how much education you have. You're going to have moments if you're a family member where you're bitter, you're angry, you're resentful, you're frustrated, all of that stuff. It's just that, know where to go when you're in those moments. And speaking to the loved one in active addiction in those moments is probably not going to be incredibly helpful.
No, no.
You know?
And you said it, not for you either, right? It's
yeah.
Not at all. It's just going to.
For anybody.
Just a feet of fire. That's burning so hot, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Listen, we've gone on for well over an hour now. fuck, we could do this one. We could do this one for hours, I think. But instead, we will switch it over to my favorite part of the show, and that's the daily gratitude. So what are you grateful for?
You know, because we've been talking about and I know the show is very much geared towards family members, but today being very explicit and talking about it and thinking back to some of, like, my experience, I think I'm just grateful for this podcast. I'm grateful for FAR Canada. I'm grateful for the fact that there are increasing supports out there for family members so that family members can feel seen and heard and validated, and so that there is the support. Because I can say too that as a family member, you get burnt out, like you get, you know, and I think that having these kinds of supports helps you not burn out. And if we burn out with healthy brains, you know, who's there then to help our loved one, right? So the more support there is for us to stay well, to feel supported, so that we spend as little time as possible in those feelings that are not constructive, I think the more we are there and available to be helpful. You know, and there is hope, right? There is hope. People do recover. You're a living example in this very moment that people do it all the time. But so programs that help families remember that and get through those moments of anger and resentment and hopelessness. Big difference from 20 something years ago, I would say. And so,
No kidding. I'm grateful to my mom, you know, because as we're sitting here thinking, I'm just like, holy fuck. And she did, our relationship was strained for a long time, mm-hmm. right? For a long time. And where that shift happened and when that shift happened exactly, if I really thought about it, I could probably bring it back to, you know, a pretty specific time period in there. But I'm just glad it happened, you know, our relationship now is, it's next level. It's amazing. What I'm really thankful for? Just normal conversations that aren't about addiction and my struggle and my, just getting on the phone with my mother and having a fucking talk.
Yeah.
You know, about life and about this going on. And she's like, she's right into protesting and the government and all that stuff out there. And, you know, she gets right into, she's passionate about it. And we don't agree on every point, but I love just listening to her talk about it, you know, because it's like some normalcy, right? And it's been a long time since I've had that with my family. So it's pretty cool.
And I'm sure, not to speak for Mama Norma, but I'm sure she would echo that, you know, because for me, you know, we talk on this podcast every Saturday, but we talk usually for at least an hour before we record. And then on top of it, you know, other days and times that are not Saturdays. And you're just such a, you're an awesome human. You're a pleasure to talk to. You're such a great friend. I can imagine that for your mom to have you back, to be able to have just regular conversations with you. I can only imagine that if I appreciate your conversation the way I do, how your mom must feel to be able to just have, you know, mundane, regular conversations with you whenever she wants. It's probably one of the biggest gifts you could ever give your mom.
Interrupted my gratitude and made me cry. Sure.
That's right.
I'm crying. You're crying. Okay. I'm also grateful to every single person who continues to watch, comment, share, you know, talk about all the things. Because every time you do any one of these things, you're getting me a little bit closer to living my best life. My best life is to continue making a humble living, spreading the message. The message is this. If you're in active addiction right now, today could be the day. Today could be the day that you start a lifelong journey. Reach out to a friend, reach out to a family member, pray, go to church, call it a detox, go to a meeting. I don't care. Do whatever it is you got to do to get that journey started, because it is so much better than the alternative. If you have a loved one who's suffering an addiction right now, you're just taking the time to listen to our conversation. Hopefully you got something out of it. You just take one more minute out of your day and text that person. Let them know they're loved.
You are loved.
That little glimmer of hope just might be the thing that brings them back. Boom. Perfect.